You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United. I'm Matt Ketchell, the North East Football App and Engagement Editor here at Chronicle Live. And we've reached episode 10 of our 30-plus episode walkthrough, the history of Newcastle United. Last week, we covered the glorious 1926-27 season and got to talk about Newcastle winning an actual top-flight title once again. Today, for episode 10, we're covering the 1931-32 season, where Newcastle United win yet more silverware, the FA Cup again. As ever, Paul Joannou, Newcastle United's official club historian, is with me. So let's get straight into it. Paul, we're 50 years into Newcastle's 140-year history. It's 1931 and Newcastle are still mourning the loss of Hughie Gallagher, who's now in London playing for Chelsea.
Well, that's right. A lot's happened in those 50 years, of course. But in 1931... We were still suffering with the loss of Hughie Gallagher in the big move to Chelsea. Life after Wee Hughie was not easy to start with for Newcastle United. Boss Andy Cunningham began to rebuild the side, trying to fill the void. There was a notable addition in a Scotland fullback called Jimmy Nelson, who was a top player with Cardiff, who were then one of the best sides in the country. He joined the club for £7,000. And he was a teammate of Gallagher in the famous Wembley Wizards match. Also to emerge were a trio of youthful forwards and midfielders. Jimmy Richardson was a local lad. Harry McMenemy came in as well, a Scot, and Sammy Weaver joined Newcastle from Hull City. And all three were to be capped, or saying that Harry McMenemy didn't actually win a cap. He was selected but had to drop out through injury, which was unlucky. And he was related to the famous footballing family of McMenemy. Lots of footballers there, including Southampton's big Geordie boss, Laurie. But United struggled that season without Gallagher again and finished in a lowly 17th place. And really, replacing Hughie Gallagher was a big problem.
Yeah, it always was going to be, wasn't it? And they weren't quite wearing numbers on the back of their shirts just yet, but who would have been wearing the metaphorical number 9 for Newcastle in the absence of Hughie?
Well, the club brought in a new striker eventually, and he was an experienced title winner with Sheffield Wednesday, who won the championship 2 years running in those days. He was an ex-style Tynesider called Jack Allen, and he made the difference going forward. In league action, United finished in mid-table in 1931-1932, but in the FA Cup, they went all the way back to Wembley Stadium.
Mm. So is the FA Cup still the main focus for Newcastle at this stage? And can you talk us a bit through the run-in up to Wembley Stadium?
Yeah, well, the Cup was a focus. Obviously, they were trying to win the league as well, but there were a lot of very good teams at that point. Arsenal were just starting to dominate the 1930s. So the FA Cup was a good option for the club. And there were some good Cup displays. They cruised through against Blackpool, then had a terrific tie with Division 3 North side Southport. Now that tie was eventually settled at a neutral Hillsborough as United won by all of 9-0, the club's record FA Cup success. They also had victories over Leicester, Watford, and Hughie Gallagher's Chelsea in the semi-final followed. And they won that one and eventually won and reached Wembley again.
Yeah, interesting that they met Hughie Gallagher's Chelsea along the way. We should mention that the night before the Watford game, the quarter-final, Frank Watt passed away at his home, close to the ground. He was aged 77. A great loss to Newcastle in football, and he was preceded by his son, wasn't he, Paul?
Yeah, Frank Senior was a great loss. He'd spent all of 37 seasons in effect as secretary come managing director of Newcastle United, and that's an awful long time through a huge degree of success. And his son was also called Frank, although to many known as Fritz. Now, he had joined the staff as a teenager and became assistant secretary to his father in 1904. And once his father died, he became a secretary in his own right and became another well-known figure in football up to his own death in 1950. So between them, the two of them had 55 years unbroken service for Newcastle United, and that's a remarkable period. And really, that's not all. Later on, Frank Jr.'s grandson, yet another Frank had a short spell at Newcastle United in the late 50s, early 60s as assistant secretary.
Amazing. If there's any members of the Watt family listening, get in touch with us. Maybe we can find a job for you at St James's Park and keep the lineage going. It just goes to show there's some big characters in Newcastle's story. Frank, one of the biggest, but not as famous as maybe he should be. And good opportunity, Paul, to recommend your book, The Ultimate Who's Who, where you can read more about Frank and his son and some of the other characters who made Newcastle United what they are.
Yeah, well, thanks for that plug. There's a supplement to the original Who's Who coming out next year, which will update everything and lots more information found on 1,000 or so Newcastle United personalities.
Yeah, look forward to that. Back to the Empire Stadium then. Who did Newcastle meet in the 1932 final?
Well, as I said, touched on just briefly, team of the 30s were an all-powerful Arsenal lineup, and they virtually dominated right through the 30s. In the Met, their old foes, Arsenal. Newcastle were underdogs and went a goal behind after only 12 minutes, so it wasn't looking good at Wembley. But United's cup side had character, like most of the Newcastle cup sides that reached the final, and they had a lot of spirit. And the battle back, with Jack Allen becoming the hero, scoring two goals. And his first went down as one of the most infamous goals in the history of the FA Cup. It was dubbed the infamous over-the-line goal. And that occurred in the 38th minute of the first half. Centre-back Dave Davidson hit a long raking pass from defence towards the Arsenal goal line. And Jimmy Richardson chased it. He stuck out his leg just to catch the ball as it crossed the line, and it went into the box, and Jack Allen rushed in and fired the ball into the net.
So yeah, that sparked quite a bit of controversy after the game. Probably a good thing there wasn't any social media, but there was quite a bit of uproar among the football community after the game, wasn't there?
There was indeed, and it's gone on for many a year thereafter. After the match, there was a lot of controversy, as you say. And the Gunners and some of the media claimed the ball was actually over the line as Richardson crossed it. Now, pictures and newsreel footage were rather inconclusive, some noting that certain pictures had even been doctored. And there was a trend for many a year that newspaper pictures could easily be doctored by moving the ball on the original image and then printing it in the newspaper, and you couldn't really tell. And I've actually seen lots of photographs, original photographs, some from the Chronicle and Journal, where your artists have penned in the ball just to make it look more realistic as the ball enters the net. So that could well have happened. But the referee was adamant. He was a chap called Percy Harper, very experienced referee in those days, and he noted it was a goal. And he was quoted with some famous words. He said, "As God is my judge, the man was in play." Now, importantly, he didn't note that the ball was in play, but the man was in play. So goodness knows what the modern style TV coverage and VAR would have made of it all these days. from what I've seen, all the images, and there's quite a lot of them floating about, you can't really tell. It may well have been over the line, but the record book says it's a goal, and Newcastle went or equalised at 1-1.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that was the same end as the goal Jeff Hurst supposedly scored in the 66 World Cup final. So it's probably a good thing Wembley didn't have goal line technology back in the day.
Yes, that's a good point. I actually didn't know that it was the same end as the Jeff Hurst goal. So that's a good catch. Yeah.
So over the line goal was the equaliser, and Jack Allen also scored the winner. Can you describe his second goal?
Yeah, well, Newcastle grabbed the winner late into the final. He went on a 30-yard run, rushed past sort of two defenders, and he hit a low shot, which bobbled a little bit and went in off the woodwork. So Newcastle won 2-1.
Sounds like a great goal to win it with. He was the hero then, Jack Allen. How about the rest of the team that day? Can you tell us about them?
Yeah, the team was a solid one with some excellent players. Albert McEnroy was a very good keeper. He had a lot of seasons with Sunderland as well. Captain was Jimmy Nelson, who I said before had joined the club. And he partnered a local lad called David Fairhurst, who later played for England at fullback. Davidson was a solid centre-back. And midfield was marshalled by the long-serving and tough Scot, Roddy McKenzie, who had played through the 20s. Creativity came from Weaver, McMenemy and Richardson, who could always grab a goal up front. And on the flanks, they had two very good wingers, Tommy Lang and Jimmy Boyd. And, of course, up front in the centre-forward role, they had Jack Allen to lead the line. And that side, you know, brought the trophy back home to Tyneside again, and there was the usual FA Cup homecoming. There were thousands and thousands on the streets to watch a bus parade through Newcastle.
Brilliant. Now, listeners might remember I read out some newspaper extracts when Newcastle finally lifted the English Cup for the first time in 1910. I found some more from April 1932, and there's some brilliant extracts that give a bit of a flavour of what the paper describes as the Northern invasion of London. So I'm going to read one here, which I think paints a nice picture of how the trip to London looked for some of the Newcastle fans. So the title here, this is the Sunday Pictorial newspaper, April 24th, 1932. A little subhead here of Miles of Trains, How London Was Stormed by Black and White Invaders. And it reads, at an early hour yesterday, London was invaded by merry rosetted Tynesiders up for to coop, which is a translation for up for the cup. I think the newspaper had to go out there. They came in their tens of thousands. Still, other crowds came from Scotland, the north of England generally, the Midlands and East Anglia. On the LNER alone, more than 25,000 were carried in 56 trains, which, if placed end to end, would be 6 miles long. No fewer than 191 saloon coaches in the cup specials were booked in advance for private parties. On the LMS system, 61 specials made the dash to London with another 30,000 people. King's Cross was literally a study in black and white, the Newcastle colours. Perhaps the most surprising thing was the proportion of women and girls who arrived. The women wore black and white in every conceivable way. The men mainly favoured a checkered beret, but now and again they too went utterly black and white. Of mascots there were dozens. One woman brought a black and white cat with her, a white bow tie tied around its neck. London's sights provided a morning's entertainment for the Newcastle supporters, and they gazed in wonder at Buckingham Palace, St James's Palace, the Horse Guards Parade and the Tower of London. Whitehall, the Strand and Piccadilly were filled with merry soccer fans. Black and white rosettes were everywhere. So there we go, one of the big first trips down to London. Sounds pretty good, eh?
Yep, well, the FA Cup was something special, and it would still be, even today, it would be a similar trip to London. And I'm just wondering how much beer and drink was swallowed on those trains going down to London.
Yeah, it doesn't specify, but we can assume it was quite a lot, and probably more on the way back. We've got an image here, Paul, and we like to flash an image up for people who watch on video or YouTube, or everything's black and white YouTube channel. This image is of the infamous over the line goal. Can you describe what we're looking at here?
Well, yes, the centre picture shows Jack Allen firing the ball into the Arsenal net, and on the right touchline, left on the picture, you can just see Jimmy Richardson just past the goal line, and he had just crossed the ball for Allen to hit the ball into the net. So there's a few other pictures from different angles, and famously there's one aerial view showing Richardson just catching the ball, and that's the one that perhaps was doctored or perhaps not, who knows.
Yeah, very dramatic picture. He's obviously steamed in there to meet the cutback, and keeper's got no chance from that range, but just glad that it counted.
Yep, that's right. And it has gone down in history, and it's still talked about even today in some quarters, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So moving on then to the following season, were Newcastle able to carry any of the momentum from this 1932 Cup final win into their domestic campaign?
Well, they did to a degree. As Cup winners, Newcastle had a much better season in 32-33. United finished in fifth place, and it seemed that Andy Cunningham had fashioned a decent lineup. There was plenty experienced and international footballers in the side. And one player stood out, and he was Sammy Weaver. He stepped up and played for England, and he was a gem of a player. And Weaver was a polished, powerful midfielder. He was developed at Hull when ex-Newcastle star Bill McCracken was manager there, and he joined Newcastle in 1929 for £2,500. Remembered, or Weaver was remembered famously for mastering the art of the long throw with a much heavier ball back then, remember. It wasn't the light plastic type ball that we've got these days. It was a pretty heavy leather case ball. But he was much... He wasn't just a long throw expert. He was a very good midfielder. He was established as an England halfback with Newcastle. He had terrific work rate, stamina, and he led Newcastle's midfield for seven seasons, totaling 230 appearances, scoring 43 goals. But as we'll see, Newcastle's relegation saw him move back to the top level with Chelsea in as 1936-37 started, but he had a good spell with Newcastle and one of the best players during those interwar years.
Yeah, that's great. A name I'd not really heard of, to be honest, Sammy Weaver. So thanks for sharing that with us. He sounds like some player. And we're going to find out in the next episode that it's not all FA Cup wins and parades. As we're going to cover 1933 to 1939, Newcastle relegated for the first time and get stuck in a bit of a second division rut. And before we go, Paul, we've had a listener question that I was wondering if you could answer. It's from a Mr. Anthony Shearer, no relation, but he asks, I'm intrigued to know why West End weren't discussed more. I understand East End were more prominent in forming United, with West End going bust, but surely they're as big a part of the history.
Well, that's a good question. Of course, Newcastle West End were a totally different club to United pioneers, Stanley FC and Newcastle East End when they changed the name. So, you know, they aren't really part of Newcastle United's history. They were formed just after Stanley were created and had a separate route over the next 10 years. They became a limited company like Newcastle East End. They had a different setup, a different board altogether, and were based at St James's Park, of course. They became Newcastle East End's great rivals and had a very interesting decade over that period. But by the summer of 1892, they ran into financial problems. They folded. And as we know, the directors of West End offered their assets, players, some of the directors as well as the lease of St James's Park to the East End club. And that's obviously how Newcastle East End moved to St James's Park, and very shortly after that changed their name to Newcastle United. So, you know, why weren't we focusing on Newcastle West End? Well, as I said, the bottom line is they were a different club, but they do deserve, they do have a very important part in Newcastle East End's story, and it's on my list to maybe get into the detail of that even more and maybe produce a little booklet about Newcastle West End. We have covered them already, of course, in my story called Pioneers of the North, which tells how football developed on Tyneside. There's chapters on Newcastle West End as there are on Newcastle East End. So, Mr. Shearer, thanks for that question, and I suggest you go and buy Pioneers of the North.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a great read. I can confirm that. And if you are really interested in the very early origins of the game in the Northeast, it's an essential one. So thanks for the question. If you have a history question, you can email those into the EIBW podcast at reachplc.com or tweet me. I'm at Ketchell on Twitter. I can ask Paul a question on your behalf. We'll be back next week to chat about how Newcastle deal with their first relegation. In the meantime, please subscribe to the Everything is Black and White podcast via whichever podcast platform you use. Follow Chronicle Live's Newcastle United channels on social media. We're at Chronicle NUFC on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. And keep an eye out for our new episodes of Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United. We bring these out every Wednesday. Lastly, stay up to date with Everything Black and White by subscribing to our daily Newcastle United newsletter. It's free. You get a morning news roundup and an evening news roundup, and breaking news as and when it happens directly emailed to your inbox. The link is in the show notes. You can click that, scroll down to Sport Newcastle United updates, tick the box, and you'll be signed up. Thanks so much for listening to Chronicle, the history of Newcastle United, with me, Matt Ketchell. and Paul join you.